Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
It would be awesome if one of those buyers materializes and buys the gas, but that hadn't happened yet. And until it does, we're not really in any different situation than we have been.
Lawmakers expressed renewed optimism and some skepticism over prospects for a gas line. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 2nd. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, charged with illegal voting, Samoan Whittier residents are at the center of a constitutional question about citizenship.
If they had been born instead in another U.S. territory, they would not be in this situation facing criminal legal peril today.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. Donald Trump's return to the presidency has buoyed hopes for the 800-mile, $44 billion Alaska LNG pipeline project. And the project, decades in the making, has taken some important steps forward in recent months. But you'd be forgiven for being skeptical. Alaskans have dreamed for decades of a line that would bring the North Slope's immense gas reserves south for export. But there's a reason it hasn't happened. Nobody has wanted to pay for it. So is a gas line more likely than ever to become a reality, or is it deja vu all over again? Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone has the story.
Suffice it to say that Governor Mike Dunleavy was encouraged when he heard Trump call out the gas line project in a speech to Congress back in March.
My administration is also working on a gigantic natural gas pipeline in Alaska, among the largest in the world, where Japan...
That's Dunleavy reacting to Trump's address in a video his office posted to social media. He's watching Trump on a smartphone, offering color commentary and raising his fist in agreement. There's some cheery acoustic guitar music you can hear in the background. And, you know, there is plenty to be excited about. The state agency shepherding the gas line project has signed an agreement handing it off to a private developer for some final engineering design work. They're hoping to get to an investment decision around the end of the year. Dunleavy, after a trip to Asia earlier this year, came home with a non-binding letter saying a Taiwanese state energy company is interested in buying gas from the project. And, of course, the president has said it's a priority, so much so that his administration is planning an Alaska summit with Asian leaders, potential gas buyers, in early June. So a lot of folks are saying things like this.
After years of uncertainty, planning, and perseverance, the AK LNG project is no longer just a vision.
State House Minority Leader Mia Costello, an Anchorage Republican, speaking at a House Resources Committee a few days ago.
It's closer than ever to becoming reality thanks to significant progress in permitting, global interest, and most importantly, renewed momentum from the federal government.
The project, though, faces a lot of the same barriers it has always faced. It's hard to build a pipeline from the Arctic, never mind an 800-mile one. And you have to have enough customers for the gas lined up for anyone to throw down the billions and billions of dollars it'll take to get it built. So Representative Zach Fields, an Anchorage Democrat, doesn't want Alaskans to get ahead of themselves. There is one potential buyer who's put pen to paper. Others haven't signed on quite yet.
I don't want the public to be misled that this is about to happen when it's not.
The project faces opposition from conservation groups who say extracting more fossil fuels would worsen climate change. But like a lot of folks in this oil and gas-friendly state, Field says it would be great if the pipeline is eventually built. It could provide some state revenue, though exactly how much isn't clear, and perhaps lower energy prices for a lot of the state's residents. So for now, Field says he's not counting his methane molecules before they come south.
I think it would be awesome if one of those buyers materializes and buys the gas, but that hadn't happened yet. And until it does, we're not really in any different situation than we have been for the last 50 years.
But one has to admit, it has been a heck of a turnaround. It was just a year ago that the future of the pipeline project was on the ropes. Lawmakers were frustrated at the gas line agency's slow progress. They floated cutting its funding and mothballing the project. One of those frustrated lawmakers was Senator Burt Stedman, a Sitka Republican and co-chair of the powerful Senate Finance Committee. But these days, he's more optimistic.
I think it was, my opinion, highly unlikely we'd get a gas line until the Trump administration came in.
Stedman says that's due in part to Trump's hardball strategy on tariffs and international trade. Japan, you know, one of the places Alaska's LNG could go, has discussed increasing natural gas imports as a way to shrink the country's trade deficit with the U.S. But Stedman says it's clear there's still a long way to go.
It remains to be seen if job-owning Japan and Korea will work to get them to write a check.
If it doesn't, though, Stedman has another idea, having the federal government kick in $20 or $30 billion up front and then selling its shares once the pipeline project is up and running. Stedman says it could even make the taxpayer some money. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
Ten people from Whittier charged with illegal voting had their initial court appearances today. It was a routine procedure in a case that has the potential to be anything but. The ten were born in American Samoa. That gives them the unique status of being U.S. nationals, born on American soil, and holders of U.S. passports, but not citizens. A group called Right to Democracy is championing their case. Founder Neil Weir held a press conference in Anchorage today.
If they had been born instead in another U.S. territory, like Guam, or the Virgin Islands, or the District of Columbia, or Alaska, they would not be in this situation facing criminal legal peril today.
Right to Democracy advocates for people born in U.S. territories, and as part of the legal team representing a previous Whittier defendant, Tupe Smith was arrested in 2023 and charged with voter fraud and related felonies after she won election to her local school board. Her challenge is before the State Court of Appeals. Meanwhile, last fall, Alaska State Troopers investigated Smith's husband and other members of their extended family in Whittier. The state brought fraud and perjury charges against the 10 defendants last month. Some defendants said officials told them they could vote in state and local elections. The case could grab the national spotlight. It's already wrapped up in a larger constitutional question about whether people born in U.S. territories have a birthright to citizenship. Weir sees that as a central issue in the Whittier cases.
It is the state's burden to prove every element of the alleged offense. And one of those elements is that they're not a citizen of the United States. We don't believe they'll be able to prove that under the Constitution.
Also, despite a lack of proof, it's a widely held belief among supporters of President Trump that non-citizens voted in massive numbers in 2020. The Whittier case doesn't fit the stolen election narrative well. Many of the defendants didn't vote in presidential election years, and in 2020, Trump swept tiny Whittier, taking 74 votes, more than double the vote total of Joe Biden. At least one of the Whittier defendants is an ardent Trump fan, to judge by his Facebook posts. Michael Pesay is Tupe Smith's husband and accused of voting in 2022 and 23. He says he loves Whittier and loved serving as a volunteer firefighter there.
After everything is done, I don't know if I want to stay back in Whittier High because I feel unwelcome.
Prosecutors say the state built the case against Pesay and the other defendants after receiving an anonymous tip that non-citizens were voting in Whittier. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, soon-to-be grads on the Kenai Peninsula learn about the harsh realities of adulthood, like paying bills.
It gives me more respect for my parents because I didn't realize how many things that they're really doing, like my Netflix and Disney Plus. They're paying like $50 a month for that.
That's ahead. Stay with us. A Wasilla man is accused of selling a teenage girl fentanyl in November and then abandoning her on a snowy trail in the middle of the night after she overdosed, authorities say. Alaska State Troopers arrested 45-year-old Sean Mobley Wednesday on charges of second-degree murder and manslaughter in the death of 16-year-old Elena Tennis. Austin McDaniel, a trooper spokesman, says half a dozen different trooper units worked together for months to identify and then arrest Mobley.
Anyone that is trafficking dangerous drugs in our state, whether it be fentanyl, meth, heroin, cocaine, know that sooner or later, one of the dozens of Alaska State Troopers that are dedicated to disrupting and dismantling drug trafficking operations are going to catch up to you, and we're going to hold you accountable for the destruction that you're causing in our state.
Charging documents against Mobley say he sold fentanyl to another man, then Tennis, on the night of November 14th. Troopers say the first buyer overdosed on the drug, and an associate had texted Mobley not to sell more to Tennis. Mobley allegedly told troopers he'd spent half an hour with Tennis that night and never saw her use drugs, but troopers say their cell phone's data placed them together outdoors at about midnight when Tennis began suffering the overdose that killed her. Although fentanyl overdose rates have fallen nationwide, they remain elevated in Alaska. Law enforcement officials say dealers have a profit motive to sell drugs in Alaska, where fentanyl can cost up to $200 a pill in rural communities. McDaniel underscores how potent and dangerous fentanyl is.
There's no such thing as a good batch of fentanyl. There's no such thing as a good batch of meth, good batch of heroin, or a good batch of carfentanyl. They're all bad batches. They are all very dangerous drugs.
Mobley was being held today at the Mat-Su pretrial facility. A program in Anchorage aims to get people experiencing homelessness into housing. And those in charge say it's working. The majority of people who've been placed in housing don't return to the streets. But as Alaska Public Media's Hannah Flohr reports, there's a problem. While there are still thousands of people waiting for homes, a lack of accessible housing means the list is barely moving.
It's Wednesday afternoon in Mountain View's Davis Park at the city's largest homeless encampment. A variety of organizations are here, offering clothes and toilet paper and medical care, and fielding requests for things like tampons.
I might, may or may not,
At one table, staff from the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness take down the names of those who'd like to get into transitional or permanent housing. It's a long list. More than 3,000 people are waiting. Tracy Wooden has been on the list for about a year.
I got sick and I get breast cancer, and we weren't able to keep up with the bills with all that, and so we lost our place.
She says she's healthy now, but she and her partner are living out of an RV packed with their belongings.
We survived the winter, and it was a tough one, I gotta say, because it was just trying to keep warm in that motorhome.
Jessica Parks is with the Coalition to End Homelessness. She says Wooden's story is not uncommon. The majority of Anchorage residents spend over half their paycheck on rent.
It's not affordable. It's not sustainable. It puts you one emergency away from homelessness, and that's what we see.
Since 2017, the Coalition to End Homelessness has been trying to move people like Wooden out of tents and shelters and RVs and into housing. So far, they've set up nearly 7,000 people. To keep their list comprehensive and up to date, the Coalition does outreach all over the city, anywhere there are people experiencing homelessness. As housing becomes available, the Coalition reaches out to whoever qualifies for that particular place. Those who have been homeless the longest get the highest priority. Once housed, their rent is subsidized through federal, state, local, and philanthropic programs. Park says data shows the program works. Less than a quarter of people given housing return to homelessness within a couple of years. So she says the fix is clear, but the problem is wait times are long because there just isn't enough accessible housing.
We never tell someone that you will be housed in this period of time because we just don't know. We don't know what will happen.
Park says that lack of housing is partly because of rental restrictions. Medical debt, like Tracy Wooden's, may show up on a credit report. Many realty companies won't rent to those with eviction records, and those numbers skyrocketed after the pandemic. And Park says there's just not a lot of new homes being built. Housing construction in Anchorage started to decrease after the recession and has really slowed to a crawl since the pandemic. There are a lot of empty commercial buildings in the city, but Park says those can't be easily turned into housing.
We have red-taped ourselves into this corner. There are so many regulations around fire code, around building safety, that it is extremely difficult to convert things like office buildings into housing.
She says there is a fair amount of money dedicated to homelessness, but it doesn't necessarily go to building homes or subsidizing rent.
What we see a lot of here in Anchorage, too, is money going into shelters. And shelters don't solve someone's homelessness.
She says getting people into housing is actually cheaper. In Anchorage, shelters cost about $100 a night per person. She says subsidies for transitional or permanent housing pencils out to less than that, just over two-thirds the amount. Tracy Wooden doesn't bother checking in with folks at the Coalition table at Davis Park. If she moves up on the list, they know where to find her. And besides, they told her not to expect housing anytime soon. But she says she's not giving up.
I would love to be able to cook in my own place and have groceries and have a refrigerator. Oh, I'm going to kiss that refrigerator and a place to do laundry.
She says once she has a home, whenever that is, the first thing she'll cook is biscuits and gravy. In Anchorage, I'm Hannah Flohr.
Hundreds gathered in the rain at Anchorage's Denali Park Strip as part of a national rally for May Day last night. The main theme of the event was to support workers with a focus on healthcare, education, and other union laborers. But many took the opportunity to criticize the Trump administration. Retired high school teacher Brad Fleener says he'd never been to a political rally before, but he was concerned that members of Congress weren't standing up to the president. He says he voted for Republicans in the past, but stood with a sign that read, "Eggs are expensive because all the chickens are in Congress." Senator Dan Sullivan and Congressman Nick Begich's faces are also on the poster.
It's going to be a political nightmare for a number of states, but probably including Alaska, that really depends on Medicaid. And these two gentlemen have voted not to support it. And that is very, very wrong.
Rallies like this have been held regularly in Alaska since Trump's inauguration in communities on and off the road system. Joelle Hall is president of the Alaska AFL-CIO, the state's largest labor union. She says these rallies have been making an impact on lawmakers. She pointed to a recent spree of television ads with lawmakers defending their records on children's issues and Medicaid as evidence, though she says the ads aren't entirely accurate.
I want you to know those ads would not be on the television in April, 18 months before the next election, if they were not feeling the heat.
The island community of Kodiak has held four rallies in recent weeks, and organizer Kathy Larson has been to all of them. She was among 60 people who lined Kodiak's busiest intersection in the rain Thursday at rush hour, holding signs. Larson says she hopes the momentum of the rallies doesn't let up, and the president heeds their messages.
Keep going, because we need to change his mind. We need to get him out, or we need a point where he needs to listen to people, not what he wants.
Rainy protests popped up in southeast Alaska communities as well. Melina Marvin helped organize a rally that brought more than 60 people to the shelter at Bushman Park in downtown Petersburg. She reminded the crowd of the jobs and funding that billionaire Elon Musk and the Trump administration's actions have taken from the local community. And together, they called upon state lawmakers to stand with the local workforce.
We in Petersburg ask you to stop allowing the executive branch to steal the powers our Constitution afforded to you as our duly elected Congress. And if you're not listening to us, we're going to keep getting louder. Are we going to keep getting louder?
Yes!
Further north in the interior, about 250 people held an evening rally at Fairbanks' Veterans Memorial Park and then lined the sidewalks on the Central Street downtown. Rallygoer Phil Drum says he took issue with the president of the National Teamsters Union endorsing tariffs and other policies he thinks will hurt workers. He held a sign that said so.
Mine says, Sean O'Brien can kiss my butt, dump Trump. Mr. O'Brien decided to side with the MAGA cult. I'm just out here to say that there's a lot of Trump supporting members and the Teamsters, and they're doing that at their own peril, and I just want to voice my protest about that.
In western Alaska, a group of two dozen protesters gathered outside the Yupit Picharorate Cultural Center in Bethel, waving signs alongside American and Ukrainian flags to lunchtime traffic. Protester Bethy Whalen says at this point, after the actions of Trump's first 100 days in office, the protests don't hinge on pre-election polarization. She says it's about what can be done now.
Anybody who wants to can come out to these protests, especially people who voted for Donald Trump and are seeing now that they actually don't want the world that he's creating, the country that he's creating.
Similar protests were held in Alaska communities and had turnouts ranging from hundreds in Juneau to more than 100 in Sitka and Soldotna. Additional interviews for this story were conducted by Olivia Rose, Robin, Samantha Watson, and Brian Vanwa. Anchorage school board members laid out a plan Wednesday to reinstate most, but not all, displaced employees and cut programs. The committee was reacting to a bill that passed the legislature with bipartisan support and includes a $700 increase to the per-student funding formula, the base student allocation. If Governor Dunleavy signs the bill, it could mean just under $50 million in additional funding for the Anchorage School District. Board member Kelly Lesson says the money would not reduce class sizes as much as she would like, but would fund many support staff critical to student success.
Right now, we will be stopping the bleeding right now. This is triage, as far as I'm concerned, to support our students to the best we can, because the job isn't done.
Board members opted to assume an increase of only $560 to the BSA until the bill becomes law. They worked off an amendment passed during the budget process in February that showed how funding from a much larger increase would be reinserted to the classroom. Nearly all cut positions would be reinstated with a $560 BSA increase, including middle and high school sports and the Ignite program for gifted students. A planned increase of 4 students per class would be reduced to just 1, and most nurses, librarians, and support staff would be reinstated. Chief Human Resources Officer Marty Lang said most displaced teachers could be reinstated at their previous school. Board member Carl Jacobs said the committee opted to assume a lower funding level because of a lack of trust for the legislature and governor.
I'm not comfortable with, given the lack of fund balance that we have, depending on the legislature to come through with exactly what they promised today. And I don't think anyone should be.
The board will meet Tuesday to vote on the Finance Committee's proposal. The governor has until May 19th to sign the funding bill, veto it, or let it become law without a signature. If he vetoes it, lawmakers have said they have the votes to override that decision. Alaska is leading the nation in job growth, and federal funding has been a huge reason why. That was a key takeaway from an economic forum with University of Alaska Anchorage economists Thursday. Brett Watson is an assistant professor of applied natural resource economics at UAA. He says it took the economy longer to recover from the COVID pandemic, but now it's the opposite. Alaska has been leading the nation in employment growth since late 2022, growing almost twice the national rate. There's 2 sectors in particular that have driven that growth, he says.
The healthcare industry and construction sector. Both of these have kind of been the leading industries for growth now for a long time in the state. As we can imagine, that federal spending has been a large driver of the post-pandemic recovery that we've seen in the state through these 2 channels.
The state gets more federal funding per capita than almost all other states, over $13 billion total, according to the presentation. That money supports things like Medicaid, the government health insurance program for low-income families, pregnant women, and others, along with nonprofits. Oil used to be the primary revenue source for the state's general fund, but Watson says it's become less reliant, partially because Alaska North Slope production has declined. Instead, there's been a growing dependency on federal funds.
One of the really dramatic things that I see in this figure is just the persistent increase in federal spending that's passed through our state's budget. That's really been on the rise, and it's kind of accelerated its trend in the last 10 years or so as well.
About 15,000 Alaskans worked for the federal government when Trump took office in January, but economists don't yet have a clear picture of how many workers were impacted by sweeping federal cuts by the administration. Meanwhile, few things are certain in life, but paying bills is one. Graduating seniors at Kenai Central High School were exposed to that reality this week through a program that places them in expected and unexpected financial situations. As KDLL's Hunter Morrison reports, students say they learned how a single money misstep can lead to rippling financial consequences.
A colorful plastic wheel that looks like one on Wheel of Fortune catches the eyes of students. One confidently walks up. But this wheel doesn't have vacations or cash prizes. The Wheel of Reality is loaded with financial burdens, like unexpected car repairs or medical bills. That student welcomes an imaginary child to the world. It's one of about a dozen financial exercises the group of seniors are put through at Kenai Central's annual Get Real Financial Reality Fair.
Those are expenses that they have to deal with sometime coming up in their life.
That's Principal Daniel Beck, who says the exercise is like the board game Life. He says it helps students realize that their time relying on mom and dad may soon be over.
At some point, their resources are going to be limited to what they earn and how hard they work for it.
The Reality Check event brings together financial advisors, teachers, and parents to help students formulate an adult budget. They account for exercises like medical insurance, mortgage or rent payments, and entertainment purchases. Senior Sarah Baisden never realized how small financial moves could have spillover effects. To save money for entertainment, like concerts, she opted for a less comprehensive health insurance plan. She says that was a mistake.
I got bad insurance, and then 2 seconds later, I had like an accident, and I had to pay a bunch of money, and I didn't realize like how much goes into all these little details about life. Like, I didn't know.
Baisden's also the mother of 3 children in the exercise. She says that's made budgeting a real challenge. She was also shocked by the general cost of living, especially for things like streaming services.
It gives me more respect for my parents because I didn't realize how many things that they're really doing. Like my Netflix and Disney Plus, they're paying like $50 a month for that, and I had no idea.
Renee Ryback is the Kenai Peninsula Area Vice President of Global Credit Union. She helped organize the event.
It's an awareness, and for most of them, a realization that this is coming soon. That whether they're going to go to college, they still have to budget, whether they're going to get a job, go to trade school, wherever they go in life, they're going to have to do some kind of budgeting.
She says the exercise makes for a more financially knowledgeable community, and they've expanded the program to other schools. In Kenai, I'm Hunter Morrison.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Chris Clint, Hannah Floor, and Ava White in Anchorage, Brian Venwa in Kodiak, Olivia Rose in Petersburg, Robin in Fairbanks, Samantha Watson in Bethel, and Hunter Morrison in Kenai. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Have a great weekend.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.